It just seemed like fine art was this domain in which you could do whatever really interested you, as long as you found an interesting way to sort of present it to the public.
Welcome to Radio Free School.
Welcome to Radio Free School.
I'm Jermaine Coe. I'm a visual artist who also curates and writes. I entered just a general arts program not knowing that I would end up graduating in fine arts. It ended up that fine arts was the domain that I thought I could do the most things. Like for me, it was really difficult to decide to narrow down to a particular field. Like I could just as easily have gone into the sciences or physical education or whatever. And it just seemed like fine art was this domain in which you could do whatever really interested you, as long as you found an interesting way to sort of present it to the public, that was going to be cool. Did sort of art classes since I was a kid, or I always did art in high school. Sort of standard drawing and painting and making things, and even in art schools, that still tends to be most art students still get that kind of traditional training in studio practices, even though contemporary art, for the most part, or a good deal of contemporary art these days, is really conceptual, that is not necessarily based in traditional studio practices, but based in like other kinds of social activities or related to other kinds of social discourses that don't necessarily have anything to do with the studio. And so many people using materials that aren't traditional art materials. So it's kind of funny that they've all come from, or for the most part, come from this traditional fine art training. So I went to art school, and I went to a program that was very strong on theory and history of 20th century art. So I think I got a good grounding in the possibilities for expanding the limits of what art was, and I think that gave me a good grounding for doing the kind of work that I'm doing now, which doesn't necessarily look like very traditional work.
Joseph Beuys.
I am trying to provide the same kind of empowering experience that Beuys was really aiming at. Like, I mean, he was understanding his work as being like a tool to provoke people to take on social power for themselves, to understand their acts as being creative. And I try to set up situations using often the stuff, materials and social practices, social exchanges that we all kind of engage in, as a way of reiterating, I guess, the importance of those kinds of practices, and to maybe encourage us to be aware of the ways in which we behave and which we interact, and of the meanings of the things, the significance of the things that surround us. So I think that there is a close parallel. There is a parallel. I mean, I think there has been a kind of fairly understated sense of activism, I guess, in my work, which has to do with suggesting quietly the kinds of points at which we might form connections with each other and thereby community. Like for example, I can give an example of a work I did in Mexico City that involved using the water bottles, that collecting all the water bottles that were littering the streets and using them to create a form within the gallery that was like a reminder of the lake that used to exist on the site of the city and that which is now depleted through the course of development of the city. So like tying up the sort of current conditions to these previous historical movements. Or even the large knit piece which is in the show. And I think that by providing the opportunity to sort of recognize the the massiveness of the kinds of things that we all engage in, that that's like maybe a point of connection that we, and a point at which we can become aware of the ways in which we live our lives. My work actually is moving towards becoming a little more explicit. My recent work, the stuff that I'm doing right now, is actually, I've done a few pieces that are more specifically and explicitly addressing like questions of housing in downtown Toronto. And, like the latest piece that I'm working on is to build a number of spider webs, like human-scaled spider webs, in sort of unused areas of seemingly unused areas of the city. You know, sort of making a parallel between what we think of as like animals barely existing in the wild and people sort of scrambling around for temporary accommodations in the city. So it's again a fairly abstract and restrained way of doing it, of getting at the question. But I think it's politically laden. I do believe in the power of quiet kinds of statements rather than kind of shouting about about one's concerns. But at the same time, I do think that I'm in a position where I could very well be more explicit about my concerns, and I think that's what I'm tending towards. I think that my work tends to be maybe understood differently within the sort of specialized art community and maybe the community at large. And I've never actually designed work for an art audience. I've always designed it for a general audience, with the belief that really, you know, I'm dealing with materials and phenomena that people really are very commonly known, very commonplace things, and with the idea that this is like hopefully provides a way in for people that they can recognize this process of knitting, and they know that people do it, and so that they're, all the elements are there for them to sort of piece through what is going on. Or so I mean, of course, you know, there is a certain inbred hostility towards contemporary art sometimes, and towards kind of especially abstract thinking kinds of work. It's a question of education. There still isn't this kind of general recognition that art doesn't necessarily have to be things that are on the walls. And also that art can be about, or that a lot of people are understanding art as being about ideas and not about beauty. And this is like a fundamental principle that I guess is still a sticking point for a lot of people. But once they get past that, I mean, there's really no reason why a person shouldn't engage. And also, I mean, I don't set my work out in the world and trumpet the fact that it's art. I just send it out there in the world just as objects, you know, these strange little tokens that somebody might try to give you. And so the explanation when passing on, you know, when these things circulate in the world, is not that they're art, but rather that they're these interesting objects that kind of look a little bit familiar, but that are somehow twisted, and that might provide the opportunity to sort of to think anew about how these objects are usually used, how they've been slightly adjusted. I really do hold this hope for that the work can be, or this belief that the work is accessible. I mean, of course, there are references, or maybe art historical references, that a specialized art audience will get, but I don't think are necessary. I think one of the routes that feminism took was to, in a way, reclaim or seek empowerment through the very means and processes that had always been the sign of their loss of power, in a certain sense. So, like, it's much the same as different cultural groups like adopting the words and slurs that have always hurt them, right? I mean, I think it's not unrelated to that. And also by like reclaiming it, to sort of to claim it as a source of power, and also to take away the ability for that to be like a means of disempowering. I think that's what's sort of behind the fact of a lot of women reworking traditional kinds of women's work. The reason the piece was conceived as a lifelong piece was that it kind of was this very simple conceptual construct: all do something and I'll do something, do it for the rest of my life, which is not so unlike someone choosing to a certain profession for the rest of their life or something like that. But it becomes like this very, for me to say that makes the piece a very terrifying proposition, even though it's not so much unlike choosing to do lots of other different kinds of things.
are listening to Radio Free School.
What I'm trying to get at with the piece, by using this quite common process all the same, is to suggest that this obsessiveness is not shared by me alone, that I happen to be the one who's decided to collect the entire output of this obsessive activity into one place, but that there are lots of other people who do it, making separate objects that get dispersed then, and so we don't necessarily see the product of their obsessiveness. It doesn't necessarily become an issue because it's not present to us in that way. Knitwork is a piece that I've been working on for a little more than 10 years now, that's conceived as a lifelong piece, a piece that I'll continue until I die. And it's made by unraveling used sweaters and then knitting them back together into this, an object that's like the width of a blanket, but never ending, so it's ever increasingly long. Now it measures maybe about 300 feet or something like 60 or 70 meters, something like that. And it just sits around, lumps around on the floor, looking like this big, sort of massive, stubborn object. I think of it as a stubborn object. Another of the works in the show is a project called Sightings, which is a series of postcards that I made from snapshots that I've found in public places. So I've got this whole archive of snapshots that I've been collecting since probably 1992. And where I've been keeping track of where and when I found them. So, and some of these I've turned into editions of postcards, editions of like 2,500 each. So the front of the card is a facsimile of the photo, the original photo, and the back is captioned with the information about where and when the photo was found. So in a certain sense, it blends together the practices of sending tourist postcards and the practices of taking snapshots, in the sense that they both are social processes that are used for recording where a person is at a particular time. It also ends up recording where these unknown people who lost the photos were at a particular place and time, and where I was at another place and time. It's sort of a play between of social conventions. So the show as a whole includes, I think it's 8 projects, three of which were brand new. I did a brand new installation in a site-specific installation in their largest gallery here. It's a fairly minimal piece, using Carlot tinsel, silver Carlot tinsel, which is strung up in parallel rows across the gallery. The origin of this piece was when I first visited the gallery and I was doing a site visit to know what the possibilities were for installing pieces here. And they told me that one couldn't install delicate works in this gallery because the new air circulation system was so powerful that it would blow things around. So I thought that this tinsel, if brought into the gallery, would show the patterns of this air movement, which it does do. There are parts of the room, it hangs below the ceiling, where the tinsel flutters more, so it kind of reveals these hidden systems of the building that we don't normally think about. And at the same time, I think it makes this kind of funny correlation between the expectations that we bring to commercials, these kinds of commercial spaces, and the expectations that we bring to galleries. They're both these quite formal and ceremonial spaces in a certain way. I mean, I like the fact that this incongruity of this material we're used to seeing outdoors, indoors, and so that there's, and yet it's waving in the same way as it would outdoors. So there's this strange confusion about where you are, And the gallery is so vast that it could very well be an outdoor space. It's, again, a quite quiet intervention into a building. There's a good measure of absurdity in a lot of my work. Because in a certain way, I think that conceptual art and a good joke are pretty close together. Like, they rely on recognizing a certain kind of social code and recognizing how it's usually used and recognizing how odd it is to twist that a little bit. So a lot of my works operate as good jokes, I think. I mean, I don't know if I consciously try to make funny work. I guess that's what my sensibility reduces to. I'm not so interested in these kinds of myths of the artist being this you know, innately creative person. But I guess if something does reduce down to something that's inherent in my personality, I guess it sort of comes down to that. This like kind of sense of funny self-deprecation or something. The self-portrait is also an ongoing piece. It's a single self-portrait that I paint over regularly so that the previous versions of the painting are no longer visible. Although, I suppose, there is this idea that maybe after my death, the biggest authority on Germain Coe will decide that, one of these past states was the definitive one, and they could, some conservator could go back and carefully excavate back to that point or something like that. So it's also, like a lot of the work, is sort of very literal, or a self-portrait is a portrait of a person, and while people change, so well the self-portrait should change. So in a certain, it's this kind of willfully literal kind of interpretation of things. It is quite difficult to undertake the work sometimes because there have been moments in that painting that I thought were really nice paintings. It is still emotionally kind of difficult to do it. It does present also a bit of a challenge to that piece is owned by an institution now, and it does, like Knit Piece, present a bit of a challenge to them. Because they had to accept it under the condition that it was going to change, which is sort of unheard of for museums, really. You know, their basic mandate is to take things and preserve them. Probably my favorite artist of all time is a Cuban artist named Felix Gonzalez Torres. His work is not actually unlike mine, I guess. He did, for example, those works where he would dump a pile of candy in a corner. That would be like this endless supply of candy that people could take away and savor as they went. And it was just these very simple gestures of generosity, but that also had this kind of sexual edge to them, maybe this sort of consumption of body or something. Because these piles of candy, they always were correlated to the weight of a particular person or a couple of people or something. Like that. I mean, he was someone who I think was really brilliant at using very minimal means to get at, you know, explicitly political issues that were emotionally effective and that politically effective at the same time. So he's kind of like a model. He's kind of a model for me. That classified ad piece, just to give background, it's a journal that I've been keeping on and off in the classified ad since 1995, and so it appears in that section of the classifieds that people use to look for long lost relatives and send prayers to the Virgin Mary and thanks to St. Jude. So it's like this section of the classified ads that's really for lost causes, and it just simply describes the usually mundane things that I engage in any particular day. Sometimes they're more affecting than that, where I'll sort of talk about having fights with so and so, or feeling left out because I didn't get invited to this or that dinner. And they're described in a general enough way that people happening upon them might take them as being the words of somebody that they know, maybe, or might recognize the situation as one that they've encountered. So I do think of it as including this possibility of people making emotional connections between them. It is a piece that I thought about for a good year before actually doing, because even though it was anonymous, it was still me putting my actual thoughts and emotions out there, which was really necessary. I mean, it really was. In order for the piece to have a kind of honesty, it had to be a real record of what I was feeling at a particular time. So because it's anonymous, there's no way really of knowing how people are taking it. We can only, I think, imagine what it is. So I think this is a piece that calls for a measure of imagination on the part of people. But there have been moments where I have imagined that there have appeared ads by other people that have been kind of in response to things that I had previously said. You know, one of the great things is the thought of other people out there doing similar things to you, or the fact that there are these possibility of connection with other people. I mean, I think that those kinds of thoughts and that process of imagination is really important. Like, it's as important but different than actually making a connection. That potential out there represents like this potential for community.
You are listening to Radio Free School on Free Radio Santa Cruz 96.3 FM, 97.9 FM, and Fredericton, New Brunswick.
What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? What did you learn in school today, dear?
The piece that's out on campus is again a fairly simple piece. It consists of a fence post, which is planted in the middle of a walking path for the duration of the show, with the idea that it would provide an opportunity to see how that space might change over the course of time. It's through the sheer force of everyday movement. I mean, walking paths are an interesting phenomenon because there are these things which show how space is actually used and adopted by people. Quite apart from the way that it's planned, quite apart from its planned uses. You know, people, no matter how you lay out a green space, people will find their own routes through it. So I mean, think of walking paths as being these kinds of objects that show the logic of unconscious everyday activity. So we put I planted this pole in the middle of the grounds people at McMaster did, but this pole in the middle of the walking path and threw a little bit of grass seed down with the idea that we might see how if the path diverts around the pole to one side or the other, or splits around the post. Would more people pass to one side or the other, or would it and I think this is actually what's happening, but you're not going to see it in 2 months. I think what's actually happening is it's serving to disperse the traffic quite a bit more than it was. So this idea that maybe this object that you wouldn't really notice after the first time you passed by it, because it just insinuates itself into the language of the architectural language of the place, could provide the means for quietly observing the just the force of everyday use of a space. That piece is kind of related to a series of work I'm doing which make or suggest commonalities between human activity and natural forces. I did another piece which was a turnstile, like a standard metal turnstile that you go at the entrance of stores, that turns automatically on its own in relation to the speed of the wind outside. So somehow suggesting that the ways in which we behave are somehow tied, correlate with weather outside. On windy days, we sort of go about our business, and if in a rush, on calm days, we might go about more leisurely. I mean, I guess the new tinsel piece installation is not unrelated to that as well. So what I'm working on right now is like, are these spider webs? I've got hatched a couple more plans for these installations with natural forces or suggesting natural forces. In each case, it's like some kind of architectural element and some kind of natural element. So I've got one that I sort of devised one that would measure the level of water, and this would have to be in a place that's beside water, that would, or actually was conceived for a place that had like a, was beside a tourist ferry boat terminal or something like that, and so that would, where there would be a bar across the entrance to a room, you know, this kind of stretchy tensor strips that would rise and fall with the level of water. When a boat pulled up and the sort of the water rises, it's a sort of like block entrance to the place. I've done a piece recently in Mexico City again, which sampled the sounds of traffic passing by a particular structure. And because Mexico is known as a city that's really congested and, you know, has bad air, transformed that sound of traffic into something that sounded like gusts of wind, and then retransmitted that by FM radio to the area so that the cars passing by could actually sort of hear themselves transformed into something more free-flowing than maybe it usually is. Yeah, I think this winter I'm going to work on some videos. I've been working more and more in relation to particular sites. It's going to be nice to have a few months to just develop new pieces that are not necessarily related to particular exhibitions. I'm kind of excited about doing this work in the streets, these spider webs and other things. I've been working, I guess more and more often outside of Canada, and that's probably the plan for the next couple years, is to work to get a bit more exposure internationally even. So it's happened that one curator sees work in a show somewhere and invites you to do something somewhere else. And so I've had a couple exhibitions that really did help, that exhibitions overseas that a lot of people saw and that people are recalling and inviting me to do things.
Yeah.
Radio Free School, a show by, for, and about home learners.
I'm gonna wrap myself in paper. I'm gonna daub myself with glue. Stick some stamps on the top of my head. I'm gonna mail myself to you.
Contact Radio Free School at grassroots@hwcn.org or mail P.O. Box 19, 1280 Main Street West, Hamilton, Ontario, Canada, L8S1CO.